Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Welcome to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd, and I'm here with my co-host tonight, Kurt McKenzie. Mr. Red Beckman will be listening tonight and maybe possibly contributing later in the show, but he has just returned home from a visit to the medical prison, and he is in fair condition and hopefully recovering from a little infection that he had, and we'll be praying for him tonight. And I just want to open us up with a prayer, as we usually do, and honor our Father in heaven. So if you'll all join me in prayer, I appreciate it. Almighty Father God, just come before you tonight, lifting up my brother Red Beckman to you and praying that your healing hand be on him, and praying that you would go before us in everything we do in this show tonight, and that we pray that everything we say will glorify you, Father. And we're just thankful for your Son and your Spirit, and we're really just pleased to know that your love is always there and your mercy is always there. And we're thankful that we can turn to you, especially in these trying times. Thank you for the opportunity to come together on this show and hopefully spread some truth out there. It's in the name of your Son, Yeshua the Christ, we pray. Amen. Let's see, it says, okay, I'm just looking at the notes here and seeing that Kirk is trying to bring his guest online, and this has been a very interesting couple of weeks, and last week our show ran a little bit longer in the first part of the show, as I was aware, and we weren't even able to talk about Andrew Breitbart and some of the other things that went on last week. And now we've got another Super Tuesday time that is come and gone. And it's been a very interesting thing to watch how this media, this government-controlled media, has done a job to try to install the people that they want as our presidential nominees. And, Red, if you're there, I believe you've got a live mic. Would you like to just say hello to the folks and let us know how you're doing?
Can you hear me?
I hear you fine, Red.
I can hear you. Well, I'm home. I've been home about an hour. And they didn't want to let me go, but I'll tell you later about what really happened, I think. And as near as I can tell right now, that infection that gave me so much trouble the last week or so came out of the hospital, and they're very nervous about it. So I almost had to sneak out of that hospital to get out. They didn't want me to leave, but I'm out, and it's good to be home. I'm going to be listening to the show. I thought I was on mute, but I guess not.
Well, we can mute you if you'd like for us to. We just wanted to.
I'll do it. I'll mute. I never punched one to get in on the show. So
no, but Kate knew people would want to hear your voice and hear you say hello, and we're just glad to know you're here with us. And
yeah,
hope
I'm
you feel
still
better.
Around. Yeah.
You got a lot yet to do, my friend.
I'll be listening. Have a good show.
Thank you, Red.
Hello, Terry.
Yes, sir, Kurt.
This is Roy Hall, the tribal chairman of the Shasta Nation. I just wanted to check in, let you know I'm here.
Wow, Roy, you sound a lot like Kirk.
Well, okay.
Well, Kirk, how about introducing your guest, and I'll turn the floor over to you. Maybe Kirk's not doesn't have a live mic. Well, Roy, how about you introduce yourself and give us a little bit of information about your background with the Shasta Nation. Kirk, are you on live now?
I am.
All right. Hello, would you like to introduce, give Roy a proper introduction?
Well, sure. I'd be happy to do that. Is Betty on? I'm on as well, Roy?
Yeah, she's right here.
Okay, well, I'm happy to have on the show tonight Betty Hall and her son, Roy Hall Jr. They're two members of the Shasta Nation, Native American tribe. And one of the stories we haven't yet covered about the whole Siskiyou County is really the involvement of the tribes in this situation. Originally, I had thought that this was somewhat unique to that situation, and so it was just particular, and I was looking for more general issues. But I'm kind of, as I'm looking around the country, I'm beginning to sense that this is kind of a pattern, that there seems to be an involvement in the tribes being pulled into these situations. So I thought tonight would be a great opportunity to get back into the story. And Roy, I think your chairman is it of the Shasta Nation tribe. And between you and your mom, you have a deep involvement in this issue. Short story here is that the Shasta Nation is the tribe for which Shasta Mountain is actually named. And this is their native land. They've been there for, I don't know, hundreds or thousands of years. And there is real issues here. They do not want the dams removed. They have some burial sites underneath the reservoirs they'd like to leave undisturbed. And there's issues about what will happen to them if some of this goes forward. So, Roy, with that brief introduction, go ahead and you can go ahead and give a more complete introduction about yourself, and then we go ahead and get started.
Yeah, I've been chairman of the Shasta Nation over 20 years, and we're here in Northern California. We're right in the middle. Well, the dam removal is all right here in our Aboriginal territory. So, like it or not, we're pulled into it, and we're a tribe with full sovereign authority. We're not federally recognized, but with our sovereign authority, that's what exactly what it is. And so we have to step up and take that because it's our right, and that's what we're about to do.
Now, do you want to, Roy, did you want to go ahead and have your mom start by giving a little background about the Shasta Nation and some of the history?
Yeah.
Did you want to start? Okay, why don't we go ahead then and get Betty on the line there?
Sure, here she is.
Okay.
Hello.
Betty, good evening. This is Kirk. Glad to have you on the radio show.
Oh, boy.
You're ready for Loaded for Bear.
Uh-huh.
Well, given a brief introduction, basically, to the issue, so feel free to give a little introduction about yourself, if you like, and then, if you would, we'll have you kind of begin the show tonight by giving some history about the Shasta Nation. You'll probably want to get into talking about how long you've been there, these are your territories, so forth, and then we'll go further into the actual issues themselves.
All right. Mm-hmm. Right now?
Yeah, go right ahead, Betty.
Okay, well, I was born in Wairika in 1934. I've been here all my life, and all my ancestors come right from Quartz Valley, where I live. My great-great-grandmother was born about 3 miles down the road from my house, and, well, we've always been here. And I have worked with my old aunties and my old uncles. My Aunt Clara Wicks lived to be 103 years old. And I gathered all around the valley with her, with herbs and things like that, went fishing with my old uncles. And so, you know, I know the area pretty well and the people. And I know there wasn't much out there about the Shasta people. And when I was 10 years old, I started saving things, documents, anything I could find about Native American people. You know, getting to read real good at fourth grade. I was, anyway. And Now I have a nice resource research library, 20 file cabinets. I didn't know it was going to work into something like that. And students come from universities like UC Los Angeles, San Francisco State, Chico State, Southern Oregon, and a lot of other historians, archaeologists, ethnographers have come through here when they're doing studies and doing research. So I really enjoy that, but I'm still very concerned about my people, and so much was lost in the early days when the first miners came in and whatnot, and the soldiers came in 1851-52, and our people were massacred. And I do the genealogy for the Shasta Nation, and I come to that 30 families that survived that era, expect 30 women that were taken by miners for their wives and lived in their different cabins up in the different draws, you know, gulches, and they survived that, and we descend from those 30 women. And five Shasta couples is all I count from that era. And 100 of our people were marched up into Oregon to the Sillettes Indian Reservation in about 1855-56. So that's why I tried to pull a lot of our history together. I interviewed a lot of the older people, our old elders, 20, 30 years ago, and got their personal stories, things what they knew, what they heard about, what had happened. So that's how I got started with all this.
Well, it's really quite a story, Betty. One question I have now: the Shasta people have essentially been there for recorded history in that same location, or did you migrate? Do you know?
No, as far as I know, they've always been here. I've never heard of any stories that they migrated.
Okay, and then the ancestral lands, as I understand it, your ancestral lands for the Shasta Nation include the three dams that are in Northern California, which are three of the four to be removed, the other one being up in Oregon. So it includes that, plus, I guess, the base of Shasta Mountain, and I guess there's quite a range there. Is that correct, though? You're the tribe that's native to that particular location?
No, the Shasta Indians are native to the Klamath River, clear to its headwaters. So John Boyle Dam is in Shasta country.
It as well. So all
yes.
four dams.
All four dams are in the Shasta Nation country. And there are extensive sacred sites in the area of John Boyle Dam. And I know there's probably more under the water. So, you know, it's a very sensitive area.
Now, I know that you and the tribe, your people, want to keep the dams. You don't want the dams taken out. Why don't you go ahead and explain that a bit?
Well, we'd rather have them stay in. You know, there wasn't anything we could do about it when the dams were put in, you know. But now there are different laws that help protect our sacred sites, village sites, burial grounds, things like that. And they might as well leave them in because underneath that water, underneath those reservoirs, are many, many village sites, sacred sites, and burial grounds. And if that water comes out and starts flushing things out, it's probably expose them, could take bones of our ancestors could be floating down the rivers. You know, how can they be protected then? Or the burial grounds exposed? Pot hunters come in. Those are people like to steal around. They like to dig up burial grounds and take artifacts and things from them. And our tribe, we have had to go to some of our sites that people reported to us that were dug into. They take machinery in there and dig big holes. And we had to spend 3 days or more with big garbage bags gathering up the remains, and how to pull them out of squirrel holes, out of the brush, to get them back together to reinter them. That's hard to do, real hard to do. And that's what's going to be happening over there if that all gets exposed. And how are they going to protect that? You know?
And what has been the response? I guess it's principally the federal government in this, or I guess state too, but most principally federal. What has been the government response to your tribe's concerns?
Well, we sent letters like everybody else, requested coordination from these all copies to the Interior Department, Mr. Salazar, to Mr. Bezdek, the gentleman that's been out here a number of times meeting with different other organizations, to the governor, and to all our representatives, and Fish and Game, Fish and Wildlife, and they just don't respond. And we just keep asking them, go to the meetings when they're here, and they just, you know, just still don't want to respond. Well, they say, oh, well, you're not federally recognized. That has nothing to do with this issues of these burial grounds and village sites and to protect them. And because we're the Aboriginal people here, and that's our Aboriginal territory, and we have sovereignty there. The Karuk has no sovereignty out here on that Klamath River from Clear Creek. If some of you look at the map, clear to the headwaters, that's all Shasta country. And they don't know anything about those sites. They don't even care about them.
Well, we probably will come back to the Kirk issue because I think mm-hmm. that has to be kind of a little bit background on it. But basically, government's non-responsive. And I guess the argument made by government is that you're not federally recognized. Now, do you mm-hmm. want to go ahead and get into that background and explain the history here?
Okay. Well, I'll say first off that, you know, when we had the meeting with the coordination meeting with the fire department at COPCO, with a lady there, Laureen Perry, it was an archaeologist, and she said she wanted to meet with us, and she will be meeting with us next week. And this is the first response we've had from anybody.
Well, that's a positive trend.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And lost my thought of your. What was the rest of your question?
Well, the question is, do you or Roy want to get into the issue now? I think we need to talk about this federal recognition and the history behind all that and where you stand today from the federal government's perspective.
Okay. Well, in 1934, this is a story here. My parents were married. They met at the Indian school in Riverside. My mother was from the Torres Martinez Indian Reservation in Southern California. That's in Coachella Valley, below Palm Springs. And, of course, my father's from up here, and he's Shasta Indian from up here. Well, they got married in 1934. She came up here. And having come from a large reservation, they had a discussion. Can the Shasta Indians get a reservation? She thought so. I think coming from a large reservation and the Reorganization Act had just passed that year. So my father gets in his little old car and he heads for Sacramento to talk to the Bureau of Indian Affairs agents down there. And he did that a number of times. Pretty soon they started coming and looking around. And 300 acres were purchased in Quartz Valley, just down the road from my house, for a reservation for the Shasta and Upper Klamath Indians. And then the first house built there was our house. And we moved there into that house when I was 4 years old. And I grew up on the Quartz Valley Indian Reservation. And, well, then there's the... Then later they purchased another 300-some acres, so the reservation came up to us. But then some Karuk people got on that reservation at the same time. But I have copies of their applications, and they wrote down that they were Klamath Indians. They didn't put down Karuk. But I think the BIA knew it, but so there was a lot of them were there. Some... Not too many Shasta families besides my father, my grandfather, and my Aunt Clara all had allotments on that reservation. And there was another man, Lawrence Purcell. And but then when termination came along, they all wanted to terminate. They wanted, because they said, then we'll have something, be sure to have this land, because they knew they weren't Shasta Indians, the rest of the Krugs that were there. But anyway, the reservation got terminated. And that was, well, it shouldn't have been. Even my husband Roy had an allotment there, but he gave it up at the time and signed it over to my Aunt Clara because they said if he was terminated, I would lose all rights and benefits from my mother's reservation where I was enrolled at that time. And it was a bad situation all around for all Shasta people. And at that time, I have government letters between the government agents that said there were only 13 families were allotted home sites on that reservation at that time, you know, Shasta and some of the Karuk. And they said all the other Shasta Indians that did not get on the reservation, get allotments, were eligible for all services And that never happened. We never knew that till I happened to find that letter in my research. So I'd say they're still federally recognized, I think, because after termination, which was illegal, it was just a policy, it wasn't a law, so the reservations were all reinstated again as to the way they were before termination. And then, well, things just kind of got, didn't run well down there. It was hard to get along with the Karuks that were there, and it was just been bad. And then they end up being a majority, and they said, oh, no, they wouldn't let any Shasta Indians back in as members. And I got some things like that. They're just wrong. And the BIA won't look at it.
Now,
so I believe the Shastas are recognized.
Now, some of this history I know goes back to the 1800s with the treaties, and I understood that your tribe, as long as other tribes, signed treaties, but they were not ratified by Congress. So perhaps you can give us a little bit of history on that.
Yes, the treaties. McKee was the agent, the commissioner that was assigned to Northern California. And I'll start it. He arrived at the Klamath River down by Wichpec, at the mouth of the Trinity River. And he made a treaty there with the Yuroks there. And also some Kayaks were signers, signed that treaty there. And that was on October 6th of 1851. Then Mr. McKee traveled on up the river. He gets to Soames Bar. And he does a treaty there with the Karuk. And that is at the mouth of the Salmon River. I believe that was on the 12th of October. And then, well, they didn't have a treaty, really. It was a supplement to the foregoing treaty. They were a supplement to the treaty that was made at the Trinity, mouth of the Trinity. So they belong with that group of people. Then McKee travels clear on up. He camps at Clear Creek on the Klamath River, and he said that was the furthest village of the Karuks coming up that river. And after he left Clear Creek, going on up to Happy Camp, he got a few miles above Clear Creek, and he said the language changed to that of the Shasta. So that just proves that he was in Shasta country then after he left Clear Creek, before he got to Happy Camp. So Happy Camp even lies in wholly within Shasta Indian territory, and it's not Karuk country, and the Karuk today have taken that as their headquarters down there.
So let me kind of back up for listeners. What you're describing is actually progress from the ocean going upstream. So the first place they come to is where they do the Karuk Treaty, and that, what location was that again?
The Yurok Treaty.
The Yurok Treaty.
At Wichpec. Mouth of the Trinity.
Mouth of the Trinity River.
Yes.
Okay, and then they continued further upstream, and then they came to, what you say, Soames Bar, where the...
Soames Bar, yes.
Soames
and
Bar.
And at the mouth of Salmon River.
Okay.
And he did a supplement there with the Karuk. So theirs was a supplement to the foregoing treaty, to the one he did before, further back down the river.
And then they continued further upstream, and they basically made a note, or he did, they made a note when he got to Clear Creek, but that was kind of the outer boundary of the Karuk tribe at that time. And then when he continued up, he came to Happy Camp and said the language had changed, and that would be the Shasta Nation people, basically. Now, Happy Camp, to give people some understanding, is, I don't know what the exact distance is, I don't know, 50 miles or so from the dams would be even further upstream from Happy Camp.
Oh, yeah, quite a ways further.
Basically, on the Happy Camp would be the western boundary.
Well, below Happy Camp, the Clear Creek is the western boundary of the Shasta.
That's where we joined them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to give it roughly because a lot of people that are listening aren't going to understand the references to creeks and so forth, but I'm trying to give some people some perspective. The dams that are going to be blown up are roughly 195, 200 miles inland, and what you're describing is some progression from the ocean going upstream, and by the time they hit basically your western boundary, you're still, I don't know, 50 miles away from the dams. The dams are further upstream, so you essentially have – your tribe has its western boundary well
out west of that dam. So there's the dams are clearly in your territory, basically.
Oh, yes. Yes, way inside. Mm-hmm.
And then what happens in the 30s then is that some of the Creek people come to the same reservation that you're in, which is now much closer to Wairika. And that's where the issues began, but that was not a native location from them. Is that correct?
Not for the Creek, no.
I see. Okay.
Not at all. Well, then the commissioner making the treaties, he came to Scott Valley, and he made a treaty close to Fort Jones in Scott Valley with the Shasta and Upper Klamath Indians here in this valley. That's a long ways from Creek country.
Okay.
And it's referred to as Treaty R. Dated November 4th, 1851. And today, the Creek tribe claim their federal recognition, and they claim that Treaty R is theirs, and it is not.
I see. Okay. So then at some point in time, and if I recall correctly, it was roughly the 1980s, if I recall. It's been a while. But the Creek tribe applies for formal recognition.
Yes.
Using Treaty R as the basis for saying, hey, that's our native land. And they were given federal recognition. And then I think it was three or four later, your tribe applied for recognition and it was denied.
Yes. Well, it isn't denied. No, we're still in the process.
Still in the process. But you applied like 20 some years ago or something, right?
Yeah, we applied in 82.
82, okay.
Yeah. And the Creeks got their federal recognition, I believe, in 79.
Okay, and so
but we didn't know they used our treaty.
Okay, now just so people can understand, so we have the issue is the Shasta Nation does not want the dams removed, both because of ancestral sites as well as if the KBRA, this Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement, is passed, essentially your rights are almost virtually, you have almost none the way it's going. But the Creek tribe is for this, and they will gain essentially control over your ancestral lands. Is that correct?
That's right. It's I think in the KBRA it says they will gain control clear up to I-5, and you know that's taken a big part of our country, and the Klamath tribe from Oregon would come down to I-5. They're going to just squeeze us out. That's not their territory. You know, we have sovereignty in all that area from Clear Creek clear up to the headwaters of the Klamath River.
Okay, got it. So where we stand is there's this history back here, and your tribe is still seeking this recognition. And if this KBRA were to be approved, not only would your ancestral lands, the villages, and your ancestors' graves be exposed, potentially even flushed downstream as 20 million cubic yards of silt go someplace, but in addition, you would really almost be dispossessed of your ancestral lands.
That's right. That's right. You know, and there's a lot of, you know, it's hard to think about that, that there's people that are buried there can be washed down the river. You know, that's hard to deal with. I find it difficult to think about.
The issue is certainly complex. I know that Roy has been attempting to do some things. Maybe we could put Roy on for a moment and ask him what some of the efforts I know that he's been engaged in.
Okay. He's been working hard.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hi, Roy. So I was thinking what we could do now, we have a little bit of history. Feel free to fill in. Also maybe talk about some of the efforts that I know that you've been engaged in and others to try and rectify the situation.
Okay. Well, I think Mom covered the early years pretty well. So we can go right into the dam removal issues, I guess. So,
you go ahead and pick right up where you'd like to start.
Okay. Well, I first heard of it was there were 27 stakeholders going to create policy and regulations for the Klamath Basin, and I didn't know what that was about. So I finally got a copy of the KBRA document, and I read it. it was a little time consuming. And so I took notes on that. And the stakeholders all had, you couldn't be a stakeholder unless you agreed with them. Their meetings were in secret. It, you know, totally no process, no government, no constitutional guarantees here. So that's what's going to happen if the, you know, if they say the dams are coming out, you know, government agencies are already acting like the dams are coming out. Well, then Congress is going to create a charter. It'll be the governing document. So we'll be governed by a charter with the tribes and environmental groups and government agencies ruling us. We will have no representation. And according to the document, we will probably be removed from the area. You know, because this is a pure case of Agenda 21.
Now, let's look, maybe for those who may not have heard some of the earlier radio shows, I'm going to briefly kind of summarize this for a second. Roy, this whole process whereby legitimate government is being bypassed in favor of these regional planning bodies, you know, because a creek crosses city boundaries, therefore we need to have a regional, you know, in the Bay Area, some kind of a regional planning committee to handle water flow or transportation or high-speed rail or up in your case, it's going to be the water on the Klamath River Basin. And that's an area, just gives people some scale, that crosses nine counties, five counties in Northern California, and these are big counties. Shasta, county up there is the fourth largest in California. And we have four up in Oregon. So now nine counties in an area that's as big, in fact, I think slightly bigger than the state of Maryland. And if this proposal goes through, effectively what's happening is government is saying these, quote, stakeholders, this is pure Agenda 21 language, will now govern that area according to the terms of this federal charter, per the terms of this agreement. And essentially, all representative government, the cities, the counties, the tribes, other tribes, everybody's out of the picture. The only people that have any stake in this are the stakeholders, which basically consist of federal government agencies, a bunch of radical environmentalists up in Portland, Oregon, and the Creek tribe, perhaps some others. But basically, nobody in Siskiyou County, whether Native American or European American, nobody really has any role in this to play at all. They're going to basically all be there. The lands that you've been on ancestrally, as well as others have been on there, are now theoretically going to be controlled by this new federal charter and bypass everything. Is that a fair summary?
That is very correct. Yes, that's exactly what's going to happen.
And the essentially, I guess it's kind of remarkable to me. It probably is to you as well, right? You know, clearly the history, I think, would suggest that your tribe, your people, have been there since time immemorial. And, you know, the federal government has professed to have a lot of interest in preserving Native American heritage and lands and rights and so forth. And yet here you clearly have lived there. There's a question politically or technically about what your legal status is from the federal government's perspective, but I don't think anybody's challenging the fact that your people have lived there. And yet they really give no consideration, or have so far given no consideration to that.
Yeah, well, we have recently taken steps to remedy that. We have incorporated a tribal court and law and order codes to assist and back up our tribal sovereignty authority. So we're stepping out in a new era.
Talk about that a little bit, because I think that's the same thing all of us are trying to rediscover is our original sovereignty. So talk about that a bit.
Yeah, so, you know, for years and years we've been told, you're not fairly recognized, you know, go shut up and sit down, especially by the federal government, Department of Interior. So that prompted me to do a lot of studying, because, you know, I don't take things literally from other people, I have to confirm it for myself. So what I found out was federal recognition has only come about recently. And what it is it's a recognition of a government-tribal relationship, which usually is money. Mm-hmm. They recognize you, you get money for your tribe. It has nothing to do with tribal power. Tribal sovereignty is where all tribes get their power. That is pre-constitution. So I looked into that, and so I also found where we have the jurisdiction to set up a tribal court without Congress's approval. And by the way, being we're not federally recognized, we're outside of the authority of the Interior Department. But we do come under congressional authority, naturally. So we're, you know, it's baby steps right now, but we're learning fast. We have to.
Well, you said tribal court. You mentioned something else you've established. What was that?
Oh, law and order codes. That is the laws which the tribal court will operate under.
Now, how do you figure the tribal court and the laws are going to help you in this matter?
Well, looked on previously, you know, you're not fairly recognized. Get out of here. Now, we have law and order codes with penalties and fines. And that makes a difference. You know, before there was no consequences. And that's what these environmental groups and agencies, the NGOs, they have no consequences. Like I talked to some NGOs here recently, and they said, you know, they're very kind and nice and no confrontation whatsoever. They never argue with you. They're non-regulatory, but then they do all these studies, and all of a sudden we find they're implemented policies. So they are these stakeholders that we're wondering who they are, but that's who they are.
Now, for example, I assume that some of these laws and orders would then apply to the situation at hand here. If your rights were, for example, violated, then you would have laws that would create penalties and fines for what, the federal government or something?
Any persons or agencies who are in Indian country. See, we're Indian country here because our treaty was never ratified, so therefore the Shastas were never incorporated into the U.S. government. So I've got to write to the Attorney General, U.S. Attorney General, and find out what that means or what they say it means. And go from there. But, you know, like I say, we come under congressional power, but we are outside of all state environmental laws and regulatory laws due to the fact that we have unextinguished title to our land, and anything with Indian interest in Indian country can come into tribal court, which has first jurisdiction. And that's over federal and state. You know, this is the law, but now the next step is to, you know, get it enforced. You know,
can when you say first jurisdiction, a decision made by the tribal court, can that be appealed to a federal court?
No. It can be appealed in tribal court, but it can't be appealed in federal court. It stands.
Okay. It's interesting to me, you know, Ray, to hear you talking about these things, because I think that, you know, there's kind of the Native American part of it, because your rights and the laws and things that govern you are quite a bit different. But in fact, you know, this idea of returning to our sovereign status is universal. You know, I hear that from Terry Dodds, one of the big ones, Red Beckman, Dr. Kate, the people who are on their show.
Yeah.
You know, this whole idea of sovereignty and the fact that the federal government seems to have usurped all that, and everybody is trying to find their way back to, you try to understand exactly what's been happening to us and how it's been happening to us and how to recover, get back to our constitutional government, get back to our sovereignty. It's very interesting what you're doing. Do you have legal advisors within your tribe?
No, just me.
you're the one doing it.
Yeah, I'm the one doing it. I called U.S. attorneys. I called Indian Legal Service, and they just got rid of me. They did not want to talk to me. Can't help me. So it's a huge undertaking, but I'm getting through this.
Now, are there any other tribes that are doing this same thing? Do you know?
No. Actually, there are no tribes outside of the Department of Interior that have a tribal court. We will probably be the first. And it is legal. You know, I'm my own worst enemy. If I come up with a plan, I have to satisfy myself that it's airtight. I mean, that it's right. You know, if something's wrong, you know, I tear it apart. So, and I just do it by researching law. If there's questions, they have to be answered. Because if you don't, you're going to be in trouble.
Now, what laws, you know, I've been doing, and I know Terry, I speak actually for everybody on the show, and a lot of other people have been doing a lot of investigation lately of constitutional Supreme Court decisions, reading the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and so forth. I'm sure the laws are quite different as they pertain to the tribe. What are the most important governing laws that you research in this regard?
Probably the most important one is where tribes have the sovereign authority to create their own tribal court. And one of the only stipulation to that is that if you must prove that you have had a tribal existence throughout time till the present, which we can prove. I mean, we have Quartz Valley Reservation. It's 3 miles down the road, or 2 miles down the road from my house here. That's our reservation. It's the Shasta Upper Klamath Reservation. And that puts us up to 1939.
And where is it that you read that you have this right? Is that some kind of a treaty document or some kind of an agreement between the tribe and the federal government? Or is this something
this is federal law. And
federal law, okay.
Yeah.
And this is federal law that relates to the Native American tribes, essentially?
Yes.
This would be like the Bureau of Indian Affairs or what?
Oh, absolutely not. Well, possibly. Like I say, Department of Interior has no jurisdiction over us, being we're outside of the U.S. government. That's just politically, I guess. You know, we're still under the plenary powers of the Congress.
And how far back in time have you had to go to, you know, it seems like when we're trying to figure these things out, we end up having to go almost back to the founding of the country or before. How far back have you had to go to kind of wind your way through this and understand it?
Back in the 30s and 40s, there was a federal attorney named Felix Cohen. Him and his staff wrote a tremendous, it's called a Federal Indian Law Book, Code and Law Book. It is the authority on federal Indian law.
What's the title again?
Felix Cohen's Handbook of Indian Law, I believe.
Okay.
And it is the authority on Indian law, and that's what I use. And it is very comprehensive and complete.
And I assume that it gives references back to prior, goes way back in time, is that?
Absolutely.
I see.
But, you know, at the same time, when you look at these laws, you also have to be aware of the current changes in law also, you know, that are applicable. So it's a huge learning process. It takes a lot of studying.
Now, your mother was mentioning that there's some kind of a recent turn of events where perhaps some representatives of government are willing to sit down and talk for the first time.
Yes, Copco Lake Fire Department actually got coordination with the Department of Interior. We tried, but that was before I realized that the Department of Interior has nothing to. They've had nothing to do with us. They never ever answered us, and now I see why. Because they don't have any authority over us. So it works both ways. Now it's a double-edged sword for them. But anyway, Copco Fire Department invited us in their coordination process, the Shasta Nation. So they're right there on Copco Lake, and our numerous burials and sacred sites underwater are a huge part of Copco Fire Department issues.
Now, Copco Lake, for people, I think that would be the lake that's the reservoir essentially that's built up behind the third dam, correct? Copco 1?
Yeah.
Okay, so people listening, that's the third dam in from the ocean. The first one would be Iron Gate. There's a small one called Copco 2. Then there's the bigger one called Copco 1, which backs up this lake. All of those are within 3 or 4 or 5 miles of each other. They're relatively close together, but just to give people some perspective. So
yeah.
right in the middle of the dams, this is right in the ground zero of the whole debate.
Yeah, they're right in the middle of all the dams, all the dam removal, everything is absolutely in the heart of Shasta Nation. Yeah.
Now, what other information would be of interest that you'd like to explain to the listeners?
Well, you know, we have all this. Well, I'll start with Agenda 21. For some people, that's starting to get old. Kind of like, for example, Wally Herger, our congressman here in Northern California.
Mm-hmm.
He issued a public statement here, I don't know, weeks ago, that he assured us that Congress has passed no bills or anything in relation to Agenda 21. That's all false. However, Agenda 21 is, you know, it's showing out, it manifests itself in every government agency and NGO, especially here in Shasta and Scott Valleys. We have groundwater council boards, surface water boards, you know, all everything. They're all, you know, all their agendas have, they all pretty much have the same sound to them. So water is the main issue here. So the Shasta Nation's court and tribal codes, we have jurisdiction on anything with Indian interest. Well, being we have unextinguished title to the land, water, and resources, that includes all of that comes into our jurisdiction. So we're not saying we want to stop any of these studies. It's just that we have the authority to say yes or no, I believe.
Yeah, very interesting. Certainly,
yeah.
They need to take you seriously instead of just kind of saying, you know. And I think that if we had the access, you know, if we had access, we could put you on national television. I think the federal government would be in a real bind because here they are violating the very thing they're always trying to preach to us, which is to protect the Native American Indians. And here they are going exactly against that. And it makes one wonder if they really care of the end result about any of that. It's all just a front for agendas they want to pursue.
This is, you know, you have to look at these things just the way they are. Okay, so the government, the rulings, I call that the ruling documents, say that, okay, that's not what they're doing. But the people, the humans, the people, the personalities that are the government, working in government, this is their agenda right now. That's why all this, you know, it's, I don't know what you call it, soft law or, you know, these regulations and policies, they're all coming from people within the government. You know, if Wally or Herger assured us that, no, it's, that's not true as far as the government's concerned. So, it's, you know, it's coming from the people in the government. So, anyway, the federal regulations and the court cases that I've read assure me that I'm right, but I'm not, you know, that's no guarantee that the government's going to, you know, say that's right. So that, you know, it kind of scares me. But, you know, when you think about it, all these huge government agencies out there, but I have to do this. It's, you know, it's, if there's jurisdiction there and you don't take it and it's yours, then that's a form of despotism. So it has to be done. It may be dangerous, but it has to be done.
Now, I know that you don't favor dam removal. I know that there's been some alternatives that have been proposed. Do you have any views on what you'd like to see as the end result of all this?
I guess there's been studied, it's been tried to, you know, have fish, natural fish bypasses, but the fish bypasses that I'm aware of were man-made. You know, the fish didn't use them. They didn't work. They didn't go around the dams. But in this particular case, around Iron Gate, up around Copco 1, is there's a natural, it's a natural, beautiful creek that comes down through there. It's a powerful little creek, and it's just tons of fish in it. And they migrate up there and spawn. Well, they can be put right around the hill and go right back in the river above the dams.
And you're talking about Bogus Creek, right?
Yeah, Bogus Creek. They can go up Bogus Creek and go around the hill and right back into the river. Because they will go up there. That's not an issue, I believe.
And that was the proposal, I think, that was made by Jerry Bocciolupi and Harry Lake?
Yeah.
Okay. And just so people know that this is like a tenth of the cost of, you know, blowing up the dams and trying to deal with 20 million cubic yards of junk that's going to be thrown downstream, and they're saying that that's okay.
Yeah.
So you're an advocate of that alternative, and I think Harry Lake is also a Shasta Nation, a Native Indian as well.
No, he's not. He's actually a Kairot. He's signed up with the Kairot tribe, yeah.
Okay. So you favor this bypass as an alternative. Now, one question for you that kind of continues to come up, you know, your people have been there for a long time. The question comes up, really, were the Coho Salmon native to this river? I mean, native to this part of the river, certainly. It's a long ways from the ocean.
They were planted in here in the late 1800s, and several times after that. Just, you know, whether they were here or not, they probably were never here. They never flourished. I mean, they were planted, you know, over 100 years ago, and they have never flourished. And we've had, you know, wet cycles, you know, prime salmon ring habitat for a lot of years. And, you know, we've had drought conditions in the last 20 years. But prior to that, I can remember, you know, year after year after year, we had lots of snow, lots of rain, the creeks ran high. You could almost walk across these creeks right here in Scott Valley on the backs of the fish you've heard that before. Well, that's the way it was. And,
you're talking about a different kind of salmon now, correct? You're talking about the kings?
Yeah.
Not the coho.
If the coho were to naturally thrive, they would have thrived, and they didn't, and they don't. You know, because, you know, it proves for 100 years that they haven't thrived. So now how much money can the government throw at them to make them thrive? It's not going to happen. Plus the additional negative factors of, offshore fishing, seals, the predators. The Yurok tribe can take 50% of every run, and they're self-monitored. So figure that out.
Now, they're about 20 miles from the ocean, roughly.
Who's that?
Is that correct? The Yurok tribe?
Oh, I think they're on the coast, Yurok tribe. Yeah, they're
pretty,
on the coast about 20 miles up.
Just so people understand is that the Native American Indian tribe that has this right is pretty close to the ocean. I think it's a little bit inland, but essentially it's a long ways away from these dams. So 50%, they have the legal right to take 50% of the salmon coming upstream, and there's nobody checking them to make sure that they're doing this. So with today's prices of salmon being as high as they are, there's some question that they're actually making a legitimate count. But just so people understand the distances involved here and how things are, that's very close to the ocean. So the coho salmon, I believe, were historically also called silver salmon. Is there any tribal memory whatsoever or any written documentation that anybody has ever produced that support the notion that they were native to this area, that they were somehow spawning in these areas before they were planted in the late 1800s?
No. I know my mother has spoken of it, and I knew some of my great-great uncles. They never mentioned coho at all. No one has ever mentioned coho or knowledge of them.
Okay, so to your understanding, they really are not native.
No.
And that's fundamental to the whole debate, because if they're not native, then none of this, all this environmental stuff and so forth, the Endangered Species Act and so forth, only pertains to native species that are native to the particular area that they're trying to change. We have on the phone here somebody who has a lot of knowledge about the Indian affairs, a lot more than I do. Dr. Kate, would you like to join the conversation? Kate, are you there? No, I guess if you want to jump in here.
I had to unmute. Wasn't expecting to pull me back in.
Well, I was kind of jumping there, but I know that I'm a novice in this area, so I thought if you guys wanted to make some comments, this would be a good time to jump in or ask some questions.
Well, I wish Red was up for jumping in, because he's got more knowledge of the waterways and the tribal stuff than I do. I've got a lot of questions, but I'm not sure that my questions would have answers. There's a lot of issues going on here that we haven't talked about. There's a lot of case law that they rely on, which of course Red would tell you that case law doesn't supersede the Constitution, because there's been a lot of bad decisions that have been made. So when you start relying on case law, then you may be outside of the Constitution, and I'm not even sure how the Constitution necessarily applies to a Native American nation. And if it's not even acknowledged, are they even calling it or considering it a nation? And now that you're finally getting their attention, it seems to me that it's going to require some local county support, and that's I believe that's a kind of a big factor. The Agenda 21 stuff, a lot of this environmental stuff, of course, they try to operate under the Commerce Clause, which, the Commerce Clause really, I don't believe, is appropriate for regulating this sort of thing. But my question would be, you know, what efforts are being made to put pressure on the feds to acknowledge them, for starters, not just these applications or playing the federal game, but what's being done to establish local support and gain local support, because it's the local people who are going to put that pressure on, because the federal government's just going to ignore everything else. And even if they meet with you or try to, you know, have a conversation or give you some feedback, that's probably going to be used more to just waste time and not really result in anything that's going to be beneficial unless you've built some local petition support. So can you address that?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So what we've been doing is I've been talking with our county sheriff, John Lopey. He has headed up, I believe now there's about a 10 sheriff. There's 10 sheriffs, constitutional sheriffs. They've formed an organization in Southern Oregon and California. And I'm working with him right now. I've talked to the Tea Party, the local Tea Party in, well, here in Wairika. And they are very excited. They said they will support us in any way they can. And, you know, I don't know if that can, you know, become nationwide or whatever. But anyway, we have a constitutional sheriff, which is good news. So that's the direction we're headed in there for, you know, backing up our authority.
Is it a requirement that the feds give acknowledgement to the tribe, or is that something that could also be done in a state?
State recognition is it's just small, you know, it's like the Heritage Commission, you know, Graves Protection Act, state acts like that. You know, we're involved in that. But that has nothing to do with anything like federal recognition. Federal recognition, like I said before, is a federal tribal trust relationship, period. Tribes' power come from their sovereign authority, not federal recognition. So we are
okay.
Exercising our sovereign, tribal sovereign authority. And it is, you know, I've looked it up, the federal laws, Congress, you know, it is legal. Congress has cannot say no, you can't do that. So we're going to do it and see where we head with it. We're law-abiding. I'm going to work with the government. You know, we're not going to overthrow the government. It's nothing like that. It's just that we're going to exercise our sovereign authority within the law.
Well, let me ask you some specific questions and see whether or not this makes sense to you.
Okay.
Are you located within the boundaries of a state?
Yes.
Can you tell me what the boundaries of the United States of America is?
To an Indian? Okay, the boundary, the way I see it, the boundary of the states, being we were never incorporated into the United States of America by treaty, the state received our Indian lands from the federal government illegally. The states have no legal power over our tribe because it wasn't done constitutionally. Our lands have been stolen. The process has been unlawful.
so have the lands of the states.
So anyway, it being this was never incorporated in the U.S. government, our Aboriginal territory is outside, is considered outside of the state. Is not within the state. That's a legal term. Yeah, we're within the we're within the geographical boundaries of the state, but we're not within the state jurisdiction.
Well, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Like the state is sovereign.
Yeah.
Your nation is sovereign, but I don't even see what right the federal government has. Constitutionally, to tell the state of California, you know, what goes on inside of their state, because it sounds like you're inside of the state of California.
Just
even though you're not, yeah. in the state.
Yeah.
So what authority then does the federal government have over property that's within the state of California? Unless they are illegally and unconstitutionally stealing that land.
That's correct. So
what's the advantage of playing the federal game? Why don't you play the local game and get local support and get them to acknowledge that you are within the state? That's like a sheriff saying you're within my county.
Yeah. Okay, the state has no regulatory power in Indian country. You know, I keep going back to, you know, we have unextinguished title.
Then how can they delegate any authority to the feds? Because all of the authority that the feds have is delegated to it by the states.
Mm-hmm. Because no one opposed them. That's why. Someone has to do it. So what, you know, I don't even know if I'm on the right track or not, but what we're going to do, I informed the local environmental groups, the fishing game, U.S. Fish and Wildlife here Tuesday, that any environmental regulations, policies and laws that these stakeholders turn out are null and void, because even if they're funded by the government, we have a lot of government agencies here doing water work and fish work and everything, and a lot of their work is going to recommend, and if it comes policy, take private property. And if it's unconstitutional, it's not gonna pass the tribe.
How many counties does your nation cover, or are you even considered to be within the jurisdiction of a county or county?
We are not in the jurisdiction of a county, but geographically, we're basically almost all of Siskiyou County and the northern portion of Shasta County.
So do the sheriffs have authority within that area?
Not with Indians. See, this is a new area. My son was cited for catching 3 fish on the Scott River, which is closed to all fishing. So we went to court for 16 months. And I represented my son, and it was a horrible battle with the judges, because we fought over, you know, I'm not a licensed attorney. The state of California, and I told him, this is Indian country. I am not required to have a license. You have no authority. And so anyway, it came down to where we won.
Oh, is that right? They actually conceded that fact that basis? Oh, that's interesting.
Who actually controls fishing on your tribal grounds?
tribally?
Yeah, who has controlled that?
No one. You know, the Shastas, we don't catch that many fish. We love to fish. We eat fish. But we don't, you know, take 50% of the take. You know, it's very just Shastas fish for subsistence and recreation.
Well, let's.
It's never been an issue.
When I go onto a reservation.
Yeah.
The tribe is where you get your permit. You know, you pay a trespass fee or whatever, and you don't need a license to fish if you have paid the fee to trespass on those tribal grounds. And
okay,
I'm wondering if there's been anything along those lines that has set a precedent on the Shasta's grounds.
The only precedent we have is the court case we just won, but as far as that precedent goes, we just set up our tribal codes, and that's part of it, which is where it's still in its infant stages.
Have members of the tribe been required to buy a license to fish on tribal grounds?
No.
So that's been a pattern that's been established for how long?
Thousands of years.
Well, you could at least establish a pattern for 100 years, right?
Possibly.
I'd say you have an estoppel condition. And does that make sense to anybody?
Yeah.
In other words,
see, the interesting thing, Gary, is there's a whole other body of relations that really come in the kicking in here, you know. It's not the stuff that, you know, we normally are thinking about. That's what's really interesting about this whole discussion. It's very similar in its nature, but the whole body of law is completely different.
It is.
Well, from my understanding of common law, there is some common law here.
Yeah.
And that is the pattern of conduct that has been going on for a long, long time that precedes even the formation of the state of California, which if you can get somebody to acknowledge that or establish that pattern, you've almost got a an adverse condition situation as well, in that you've had use without objection to that use for, I'm sure, far beyond what the law states for adverse possession in the state of California.
Yeah.
So there's two different things there. One, you've got an estoppel condition that they can't just come in and arbitrarily change the way things have been conducted for a long time, which really is a form of common law. And you've got also an adverse possession situation that could be claimed as well.
Okay.
That those two things could be asserted. And if you can get the people in the local area, especially the state, to concede to that, I think the feds would have a lot of trouble coming in and trespassing.
Yeah. You know, I'm not a lawyer. I just started picking up law books a couple of years ago, and, you know, a lot of, you know, I haven't discovered a lot of things yet.
I'm not a lawyer either, but I
yeah.
am a licensed real estate broker who's
yeah.
who's practiced real estate for almost 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I've dealt with a number of adverse possession situations, and I've dealt with a whole bunch of estoppel situations. And
I see.
Those are two things that historically have held up very well in court.
Okay. Thank you. I'll check them out.
Dr. Kate has sent a note saying Congress can regulate the trade among the Indian nations, but they haven't acknowledged you guys as a nation, have they?
They haven't acknowledged us as an Indian tribe. So actually, we are a foreign nation. domestic foreign nation.
Have they given you anything acknowledging that?
No, the government doesn't respond to anything in paper.
Well, possession is another major part of the law, and it's especially in common law. It's probably 10/10 rather than 9/10.
Yeah, it is.
You know, so they're trying to get possession, and if they can dispossess you, then they are in essence adversely possessing without any real authority to do that. And it would seem to me that the state and possibly even the counties could put a stop to that.
Yeah, that's good to know. I was just reading adverse possession the other night, and I don't agree with it personally, but I guess it is the law. So that's what they're doing. So I guess that's another way to fight it.
What kind of documentation do you have documenting trade amongst other groups, whether it's other Indian nations or local community? I'm trying to establish a pattern of standing here. In other words, if they've traded with you, then that's also established a pattern of acknowledging the existence of the tribe.
Yeah, we traded with, I think we have documentation of trading with other tribes while they were still here. And, you know, neighboring tribes and the neighboring counties and such.
How much documentation do you have of that?
Oh, I think enough.
Because, you know, if you can get somebody to corroborate and do it in writing, that would substantially strengthen your case, I would think.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm just trying to think outside the box here.
Yeah.
Because it seems like, you know, if you look at the federal case law, it's going to be tainted. It's going to be corrupted. It's going to be a function of their agenda as opposed to common law or even a constitutional connection. They're obviously stepping on the Constitution. So you can try to tie it back to the Constitution, but it seems like it's going to be easier to tie it back into an estoppel condition and an adverse possession condition and establishment of acknowledgement of your tribe because of the trade. Those are all things that I would think would greatly strengthen your case.
Okay.
And getting local acknowledgement of that would make it difficult for the feds to dispute.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we probably should have some continuing a conversation sometime on that.
Well, we do have some folks that that have some good ideas, and
yeah.
I wish Red was a little bit had a little bit more energy tonight. I'm Red. Are you still there? Can we get him unmuted and just get your feedback for a minute if you're up to it, Red? He may have been too tired. You know, just getting back in from an infection at the hospital, his energy is definitely not 100%. Red, are you live now? Yeah, I think he said he was going to mute himself. So,
oh.
I believe he would have to unmute himself. We've unmuted him on our end, but he has a live mic, but he may be.
Can
muted.
You hear me?
We hear you now, Red.
Okay. I'll tell you, we need to make a connection as a factor in this process. between the spiritual and the political. And about all I would say is that there are two kingdoms always struggling for dominion. You have the struggle for that which is right and just, honest, truthful, and you have the struggle for that which is false, that which is fraudulent, and you always have people that they want to control the world. And you see, right now we've got, on an international scale, of course, you've got, we're hearing a great deal about the Muslims and how they want to rule the world.
Yeah.
And so you've got a very, very noticeable situation where you have confusion. Confusion is just, it is just everywhere you look, you have this confusion, and the confusion, I'm having trouble talking here because I had teeth pulled and a plate put in that I'm not used to yet, so I'm not talking as clear as I would like. But what I want to say is that every time you're dealing with something like this, you always want to be aware of these two, you might say, two entities trying for dominion or trying for to control others and enslave others. And that's the kingdom of evil and injustice and all. They thrive on enslaving people and stealing from people, taking their lands, taking their properties, taking their children. All of this kind of thing, you see, is all... it's all part of this effort on the part of, well, you see it right here in our country. It has been very visible in the large cities such as New York. You've always got the underground, the mafia. You've got the righteous, the people that want to do things right. They want to do things properly and in order, and there's always that conflict. And so I think as we need to, as we try to sort through what you got there in Northern California, we need to think about this, the fact that there are those with evil intent, and I'm talking about spiritual, and political. They have evil intent behind their, that's their motivation. And so want to, I think we will be more effective in this struggle if we identify that evil force out there for what it is, because I think that you'll find that they can only operate in the shadows. They can only operate secretively. And such, and then, try to do what they want to do with, saying, well, we have control. We were given control by such and such an entity or whatever. And so
anyway, it's just something that it's a factor that will help us to evaluate what's going on. What's
yeah.
the evil intent of some of these people? Your greenies and such, almost without exception, they're involved in Agenda 21. Well, if Agenda
yeah.
21 is not a an honest effort or truth a true effort to control and maintain a governmental system on a worldwide scale. It's more than that. It's so that they can enslave. They can enslave, and they can, you know, and you don't ever want to forget the temptation of our Messiah King when he was baptized in the Jordan River. He went into the wilderness for 40 days, and Lucifer came to him and took him up on a high mountain, and he showed him the wealth, power, and kingdoms of the earth. And he said, they're all yours if you'll serve me. And so those kind of forces are still active to this day.
Yes,
there
they are.
There are those who want the wealth, the power, and the kingdoms of the earth. And they don't want to pay for them or, you know, there's no way they can get them lawfully. The only way they can get them is by way of subversion, corruption, fraud, racketeering of all kinds. And it's just, it's around us. We're surrounded with it every day. And I don't think we're really equipped to confront it unless we understand this simple principle. And that's all I have to say for tonight, I think.
Yeah, that's right on. Yep, because you can see it. They want this to be one world, one kingdom.
The I think it's really pertinent, too. It's interesting, Red, because, you know, I think you're absolutely correct in that there's a set of values, and there are two sets here, and they're an absolutely contradiction. One's going to win, one's going to lose. right now, I think we're on the losing end of this. There is a deal, and I think that there is a way for a lot of people, you know, to come together on a set of values. You know, some of the Native American Indians would not necessarily be Christians. There's a Buddhist that aren't Christians. You know, I think there's a way to come together on a set of values, because fundamentally we the people are going to have to decide whether we're going to be slaves or we're going to be free men, and that's really what it has to do. There is a direction in this conversation I'd like to go. I don't know if this is the proper point, Terry. Are there any other things you want to wrap up on the conversation? Because there's another direction I'd like to take this.
I just wanted to thank Red for you know, taking the time tonight under his conditions and yeah. setting our compasses straight, because what he's saying is absolutely true. And one of the things that we forget in all of this is that whatever decisions are made should be for the public good. And if what they're doing is not for the public good, then the public's got to take a stand. They can only continue to do what's against the public good if the public allows them to do it. And I believe that all of these things that I mentioned a while ago about documenting, you know, this pattern of conduct over a number of years is to show that the public good has been served by the existing conditions, and that what they are doing is against the public good, and therefore, regardless of what any federal case law has to say, you know, the public must be served. And I'm seeing a tie to what Red is saying there. You know, God put this earth in the orbit that it's in for us. All of this creation was for us. And no one can deny that standing unless we stand by and just let them do it. And that's what's been happening. So I come back to the local support issue and how important I believe that is. And there has to be a dialogue. There has to be an acceptance. There has to be an establishment of a pattern on a local basis and
now,
get an
Terry?
Acknowledgement of the local people. Yes.
Yeah, this is Red again. You see, we've been losing this because we have not discerned, you see, these two dominant, forces on the planet, the good and the good versus evil. We haven't identified our side of this. The other side, they've been very active with their subversion and all, and we didn't recognize it for what it is, and as a result, we're losing. So the key is, and I think we can see a difference right now over the past several months, that the Agenda 21 people are getting very nervous because their lies, their thievery, their racketeering and all is being exposed for what it is. And so I think we are going to win. Good will win over evil because you have the help of the superpower, you might say. And so we lost until we woke up and started paying attention and recognizing what we're up against. So I think that it's changing and changing very rapidly, and we can be very much a part of it. That's all I want to say.
Thanks, Red. And that's all I have to say too, Kurt. So
okay, well, I think it's a great topic. Before I move on to a different direction, Roy, do you want to make any comments?
That's absolutely correct, because you see it everywhere, and nobody says anything. You know, the good people have been quiet.
I think ultimately, you know, good has to do with individual freedom, and I think ultimately that wins provided you have a society where the majority actually makes the decisions, and this is what this country is supposed to be about, and I think that we've all come to the recognition here that a very tiny minority has grabbed control of this country and flanked the world, and they're the international bankers, and I don't want to take us down that as a conversation at the moment.
Yeah.
I do want to get back to the Native American India thing, but I think we... In everything we do, we have to recognize who's on the opposite side of this war.
Mm-hmm.
The area I'd like to go into next, if you don't mind, Roy, is the question I kind of hinted at the beginning of this whole conversation. When I first came up to Siskiyou County and had a chance to meet you and your mother and your father and hear about some of these issues, you know, at the time I saw this as kind of a local issue in an already complicated situation, and I kind of intentionally decided I wouldn't throw it in the hopper because I was trying to figure out what the general issues were that would really pertain. So it wasn't just the Siskiyou County story. It was just a microcosm of the rural America story. But as I began to become a little bit more knowledgeable about some of these environmental issues across the country, what I'm beginning to see is a pattern where you have tribes involved in these matters to quite an extent. And it's almost like, you know, this country didn't used to believe in gambling. It was a bad thing. And somehow it spread. And the way it spread is by people hooking up with the tribes and using the powers of the tribes. And it seems like something similar is going on here like that. I'm completely ignorant of it, but I'm beginning to see a connection there. Am I right or wrong in that?
I think you're absolutely right that these environmental groups, even globally, are piggybacking on tribes. And tribes see something in it for themselves, so they like that. They've got outside interest and power behind them.
And is the basic thing they're trying to, like in gambling, the basic thing they're trying to tap into is kind of the special status of the tribes and using that?
Yeah, I don't know too much about the gambling, but...
gambling was, prohibited in this country,
right.
Period. And then the first breach of that, the major breach of that, was when California said, hey, we can fund the school education by, raffles or whatever the darn things, you buy your buck, and all of a sudden gambling came back into vogue, of course, Las Vegas, and then that spread because they realized that they could put gambling wherever a tribe was because the federal laws prohibitions did not apply. And so gambling began to spread really into a lot of communities through tribal lands, and that's how that kind of happened. That's what I was referring to. But it seems like they're using that once again, and I guess there's some Indians that are going to benefit tremendously from that. I don't know that the tribes necessarily do, but it seems to be something I'm seeing, a pattern I'm seeing, and that's what I wanted to know more about.
Yeah, we've been contacted by gambling promoters. We've got backing. We can do this for you. We'll help you do this. And, if they're your best friend and they'll set you up in gambling. But, we don't talk to them.
But I wasn't, I was actually trying to use that as kind of the analogy because it seems to me, separate from gambling, that they're doing the same thing here in environmental issues. Somehow it seems... fairly frequently, when you have one of these kind of things like Shiskiyou County, where the environmentalists are coming on in, there somehow seems to be a Native American component to the story, and that's the thing I'm beginning to see more of.
Yeah, it's like down here at the Kayrock Tribe, they're the driving force behind this dam removal, the tribal driving force, and they're up here. They're an alien tribe. Infringing on the Shastas up here, they're doing fish studies and water studies, and we've got to put a stop to that. We've got to step up and take charge here. And it isn't so much the Kayrock tribe as it is Craig Tucker who is doing all this. He does all this environmental work for them. And he's not an Indian. I guess he's hired by them. And, he believes in global dam removal, and he's a powerful force in that tribe.
And that's one thing I've come to really begin to understand in this situation. We often think about the tribe as kind of a cohesive thing, but I think in this situation I've become more aware. It actually gets down to individuals. Not necessarily the tribe members are behind this at all, but some of the people who got power, it seems like the way they're getting power is by affiliating themselves with some of these federal programs. They're bringing money into the community.
Yeah, absolutely. And, these federal programs coming in and, to implement, and somebody has to lose, private property rights and interests. And it's by implication. There's no law. It's just, this is what we're doing, and this is, by the way, you just lost your rights.
It seems like the return to wampum in the day, what was it, the island of New York was bought for, beads or something?
Mm-hmm.
Seems
yeah.
like it's the system seems to want to find somebody and say, that's the representative of these people, and now this representative says, okay, we all take the beads. And sure, you can have the land, I don't mind. And it seems like that's happening all over again to me. They're coming with beads to certain people, and they're once again selling out the tribes and everything else.
That is what's happening.
Is there any kind of cooperative effort between tribes that are like-minded to work together at all?
For dam removal or not?
just these whole environmental issues and private property rights and so forth. Is there any?
Oh, not yet. I have yet to see any of that. But what I'm going to do is, there are no Indian treaties in California. They're all executive order reservations. But there is ratified treaties, and we're one of them. And when I get this straight, I'm going to get those other 17 treaties on treaty tribes on board, and they're scattered throughout California.
Explain what executive order reservation is.
That's where a president can create a reservation. It's not done by treaty. There are no Indian treaties. After 1871, I believe, Congress felt left out, so they changed the rule. So there are no treaty tribes in California. They're just executive order. And executive order reservations can be abolished, too. They don't have the status or authority of a treaty tribe.
Now, when the executive order creates a reservation, how do certain people get affiliated with this reservation versus that reservation?
Usually they go back to 1851. They call that contact time. Well, that was our tribe anyway. And it's who were Indians at the time of let's just take us, for example, 1851. If you can prove your ancestry in a specific area, you were considered part of that tribe. Or Congress can place different tribes on a reservation with another tribe, and that's been done too, and be part of that reservation, not tribe, but reservation.
Now, does the government make the decision then which one you belong to, or is there kind of a free choice in this process?
No, there's no free choice. That's where tribes get their power. It's called tribal sovereignty. If you are from the land, that's where sovereignty is derived from. And as the Shastas in our treaty are, we are of the land and descendants of the treaty signers, the Shasta people, and we've got the Kairoc tribe recognized with our treaty, and it's totally illegal. And the Department of Interior, they did it, and they're sticking to it, you know. That's their story, and they're sticking to it.
Now, getting back to this idea of synergy and working together now, And to answer a question, Terry, you asked earlier, I know that Roy and his mom and the people are very closely coordinating with the other groups. So the Siskiyou County Water Users Association, the Scott Valley Protect Our Water Group, the Wairika Tea Party, the sheriff. I mean, they are basically working hand in hand with the rest of the people there to try and make a logic out of a situation that seems to defy logic and science.
Yes.
Justice to the whole situation. Anything else you want to add on this one topic here, Roy? Anything further about this apparent use of tribes across the country to now move forward an environmental agenda, 21 agenda?
Well, I think this started 30-some years ago, for us anyway, with the Kairoc tribe recognition, because they used our treaty, and slowly over the years the Department of Interior, Bureau of Indian Affairs, has used that to continually push us aside. They got us off of Coarse Valley Reservation and put Kairocs on there, and it's clearly, you know, it's a Shasta and Upper Klamath Reservation. And you know, this is a conspiracy that has started, I believe, back then, and it's coming to fruition now. Because now we've got the Klamath tribe. They're going to split the Shasta assets with the Kairoc tribe, and we're history if the dams come out.
Am I correct in understanding in the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement, the KBRA, that the – how do you – I pronounce it Kairoc, and that's probably wrong. How do you pronounce it?
I've always pronounced it Kairoc. They pronounce it differently, too. Yeah, I don't know.
Kairoc.
Sure.
they get $80 million to be part of the restoration effort, if I remember correctly. Is that right?
I think it's $800 million. It's something
crazy.
They get a lot
of money.
They get a lot of money.
And control over your land.
Yeah, and all control over our land, absolutely.
They're going to take the wampum.
Mm-hmm. They think.
Interesting. We've got about 15 minutes left. Terry, that was kind of the one other topic I wanted to cover before we close the show. Have you got some further things that you'd like to go into?
Well, I was thinking about if they enter into certain agreements, maybe there might be some kind of limited intergovernmental agreement where they could give certain jurisdiction, for example, limited jurisdiction or with the sheriff's department through the county, or even some kind of lease or use right type of agreement with the local authority, then that would also be another way to get acknowledgement of the existence of the tribe. But it would also give some authority for the sheriff to resist any outside tyranny coming into what could occur within the county boundaries.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure about that process yet, but I've yet to meet with the sheriff. I've given him some of this documentation, and I'm waiting to hear back from him. But we want to head in that direction. I do anyway. Oh, yeah, our tribe does.
You know, you want to make sure that you have the right to unilaterally withdraw under certain circumstances. In other words, if another sheriff comes into office or there's an election, you might want to have some way of getting out of that government-to-government agreement.
Yeah.
If an adverse personality shows its head. But it seems that, a government-to-government operation there could give credence to your tribe as well as increase the ability of the sheriff to afford you some protection.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just brainstorming here. Trying to get ideas out there.
Uh-huh. I'm writing them down. for recognition means is money, federal money. That's how tribes operate. We have no money. So we could be, we're not dependent on the sheriff, but we could sure use his cooperation.
Federal money comes with strings.
That's right.
You don't get those entitlements without giving up some rights. You basically go from a right to a privilege. And you don't want that. So you guys have got to figure out how to work with a local community and sustain yourselves in the absence of selling your soul to the federal god.
That's right. That's what we're up against right now. And we do have, I've brought this up in several public meetings, and the support has been great. The public support.
Yeah, I think there seems to be, Terry, just so you know, when I was up there and every time, they're amazing cooperation. These are people who live in the same community who share the same interests and, frankly, a lot of the same values. And there's a lot of cooperation amongst the local groups there although the legal issues are so vastly different between the tribes or whatever, they are working together and they do have a common objective here.
Yeah.
Well, Roy, I haven't heard you talk too much about how you feel about this. I've heard about how you think about this, I'm curious as to what this is doing to your tribe. I would think that this may even be bringing some people together. I know, for example, you know, amongst mountain communities, it's very, very difficult to get the people in those communities to come together and agree on anything. And I've witnessed a little bit of that in tribes as well, to get all these people together. But if you go in there and you try to ram something down your throat, it can be a great opportunity to bring the people together and have them fight as one.
Yeah, and it's
so. What's going on there? What are you seeing? What are you seeing within the tribe?
First of all, it's education. When people realize the issues and what's coming out there, then they even if they're not really interested, at least they do show some interest and do take part. You know, whatever, everybody takes part at a different level, but you know, education is the key. And people are coming together in all the communities in the tribe.
Well, that sounds like a lot like the Patriot community all the way across the country.
Yeah.
You know, that's the reason we do this show.
Absolutely.
Now, one thing I suggest, we're down to, about 9 minutes or so. Roy, I want to give your mom a chance. She's patiently been sitting there probably listening and so forth, but would you kind of tap her and see if there are any comments that either of you would like to make before? I don't want to run out of time and then find out there's something you wanted to say, so maybe if there's anything your mom would like to add at this point.
Sure.
Has she heard the question that I asked?
No.
Can you relate it to her?
I'll let you do that.
Okay.
Get it straight. No third party.
Hello.
Hello. Your son is a typical male and prefers to stay in an isolation condition rather than really talk about his feelings. So we thought we'd better bring somebody on that might be more in touch with their feelings here. And I'm being humorous because we all suffer from that condition. I asked him about what this is doing within the tribes. Is this bringing people together? Is it creating division? How is it impacting your feelings? What's going on inside the tribe with all of this going on is what I'm trying to get at. But I really would like to know how you feel about all of this.
I think, I know, I'll start with our council members. They're, you know, very concerned about what's going on. You know, over the years, we've been just hammered so much all the time, you know, but the council was really anxious about starting the tribal council. One lady had been involved with tribal councils with an S-peer. She thought it was a good thing. And we've got to keep moving forward with it. And then at some of these other meetings, one day I spoke to a group, the Tea Party group, and there was some Shasta Indians there, one woman. Oh, my goodness, she was a regular cheering party there, you know. Got really excited about it. And those I meet on the street and whatnot will don't say too much, but they're really concerned. They just, like, what's going to happen, you know? It's scary to them of what is going on right now. With the dams coming out and this and that, because it's just, it is. It's really hard to deal with. And but Roy is a voracious reader and always has been, and he's working hard with this and sharing it with everybody. And they like that. And it's a hard situation for us, you know, all of us. So I know they're really concerned, and, you know, what's going to happen, you know. So
well, what we've been trying to talk about, and I suppose you haven't been able to hear everything we've said, but we've tried to talk about proactive solutions, some ways that you can actually take some action rather than sitting back and waiting and wringing the hands about being fearful about what's going on, but to take some proactive action that will put you more on the offensive in this situation, so that You're not just waiting for them to enslave you. You're or to tell you where you have to go or where you what you have to breathe or what you have to eat, which is basically what this country's been doing, allowing these usurpers, these people who really have no real authority, to come in and to dictate to other people and take their rights and convert them to some kind of license condition where they can tax you on it.
We're seeing that with the non-Indian people, you know, we're being really, and they're being passive about it, I think. Well, we don't know. I think they're worried and concerned, too, and don't know how to really fight this. I know I have put together two CDs that I sent off to telling you, like, everything we talked about here, of the history of our tribes and the Kriuk and what is going on, and about the village sites, and I sent that, you know, from President Obama to clear on down to the Secretary of Interior, and like I say, they just don't respond. Well, finally, they're going to come talk to us next week about these village sites, but it's been hard to get them to even answer us, even talk to us, you know. They just don't want to do it.
Did you hear what Red Beckman said about this being a spiritual battle?
No, I didn't.
Were you able to hear any of that?
No.
You know, I believe it's really critical, and Red brought this out well, and I don't really have the time or the inclination to try to repeat it all, but essentially what he's saying is that until you really understand who your enemy is, you're not going to be able to or have any success in battling what's going on. And I'm wondering if your people are coming together at a spiritual level to recognize that this is a spiritual attack,
mm-hmm.
and that they need to come together on a spiritual level before, you know, the higher power, the creator, can go before you and fight this battle on your behalf, because we need some intercession here. We're fighting a real evil. We're fighting these people that we're fighting against are Luciferians. And if do you know who Lucifer is?
Yes.
Okay.
That is happening, and we have some medicine people who have been working on that, and they are very powerful. And I think so. We have to have faith too, you know, and. I believe now the one lady came to me, and believe it or not, she's not an Indian, but she had a vision about the Indians rising up. She didn't know what it was about or why it happened, but she had to tell me about it. And right here in our country, it happened. She said she saw it. So they're being shown things, and even I thought that was quite tremendous. And yes, we are hanging in there spiritually. And working together, because that's, you know, we always did.
I can tell you one thing on the feeling part of this. Tell you one thing on the feeling part of this, Terry. In addition, is just so you know, when I visited there, Betty, I got some film of Betty, and she's there, and she has photographs of some of her ancestors. You know, very proud Native American Indians, and obviously people who lived off the land, pretty rugged folks, and. You know, I can tell you this. She was in tears when she talked about what's happening to her situation. It is an emotional situation going on here. You can imagine, you know, being displaced from your ancestral lands that you've been on for, you know, who knows when, thousands of years, and people have stayed there, and all of a sudden things are beginning to change in a way that's completely wrong.
It is hard, and our people are coming together along that line, and spiritually they're each doing it, sometimes in their own way, have their own sacred places they go to, you know, where their families were, and it is really touching, and it's hard for them to talk about it, you know, because, well, it's not ancient history to us, you know, it's happened not too long ago.
Kurt, 30 seconds.
Well, I don't think we want to see him being put on the train again and relocated.
Right.
I mean, these people, you know, have a right here. It obviously gets muddled because now a lot of people have lived in these places and so forth. But, you know, it's certainly not right what's happening. There's no moral. There's certainly, the federal government is not on the moral high ground here by any means.
No.
They're not,
no.
In my opinion, on a legal ground either, but they're certainly not on a moral ground.
and that's wrong.
That's right. We'll all be displaced, not just Indians, I think.
Well,
this happened.
Listen, Betty, I appreciate your time and yours and Roy's. You've been fantastic, and hopefully this will help.
Yeah, I hope so, and thank you so much. This
thank
means
you.
A lot. It means a lot. Well, that's great.
God bless you all, and we'll see you next week for Walls
all right.
in Our Minds.
Okay, thank you.
Good night, Betty.
The real world outside with those pirates in. Fucking sailors dirty lips. They rule the night. They rule the night. Don't be afraid of the wicked men. There's more of us than there are of them. Come join the fight.